Blog Talk Radio.
Before, yeah, we fuss and fight, but them my sisters and brothers. I got
taught me how to hustle. First time I ever served some time in jail was with my uncle. Damn, I was hot, the cops stayed on my bumper. When I should have been at home getting ready for school in the morning. But I was always there, even though I was yawning, trying to sell the candy I sold at the store on the corner. Lost at my house again in a stolen car with my friends. Well, I end up in prison, my brother got killed. Then we both had kids when we was down serving beers. Still blessed to pick up a phone, call my mom and dad. To make a long story short, if it quack, then it's a duck. Keep your mind out them streets and your head in them books. Come on with the hook.
We belong, that's just for us. This ain't gotta get all dressed up and be Hollywood. You know what I mean? Where the f*** go when we die? Ain't no heaven for a thug. That's why we go to Thug Mansion. That's the only place where thugs getting free, and you gotta be a G. At Thug Mansion.
A place to spend my quiet night. Time to unwind, so much pressure in this life of mine. I cried times I once contemplated. And would have tried, but when I held that, all I could see was my mama's eyes. No one knows my struggle, they only see the trouble. Not knowing it's hard to carry on when no one loves you. Picture me inside the misery of poverty. No man alive has ever witnessed struggles I survived. Praying hard for better days, promise to hold on. Me and my dogs ain't have a choice but to roll on. We found a finally spot to kick it, where we could drink liquor and no one pick us over tricks. A spot where we can peace. And even though we G's, we still visualize places that we can roll a piece. And in my mind's eye, I see this place, the players going fast. I got a spot for us all, so we can ball at Thug Mansion.
Every corner, every city, there's a place where life's a little easy. Little Hennessy, we back and cool. Every hour, cause it's all good. We all stretch from the world outside. Never be wrong, nothing will be alright.
I wanna go,
nothing but peace.
I wanna go,
the street passion.
A place where death doesn't reside, just thugs who collide, not the start beepers. No cops rolling by, no policemen, no homicide, no chalk in the streets, no reason for nobody's mama to cry. See, I'm a good guy, I'm trying to stick around for my daughter. But if I should die, I know all of my album supporter. This whole year's been crazy, ask the Holy Spirit to save me. Only difference from me and Ozzy Davis, gray hair maybe. Cause I feel like my eyes saw too much suffering. I'm just 20 some odd years, I done lost my mother and I cry tears of joy. I know she smiles on a boy, I dream of you more. My love goes to Afeni Shakur, cause like Ann Jones, she raised a ghetto kid. king in a war. And just for that alone, she shouldn't feel no pain no more. Cause one day we'll all be together, sipping heavenly champagne where angels soar, with golden rings and thugs mansion.
There's a place where life's a little easy. Single pen of seed, we back and cool. Every hour, cause it's all good. And no stress from the world outside. Every wrong done will be alright. Nothing but peace, love. It's true passion.
Mama, don't cry, your baby boy's doing good. Tell the homies I'm in heaven and they ain't got hood. Seen a show with Marvin Gaye last night. It had me shook, dripping peppermint snot with Jackie Wilson and Sam Cooke. Then some lady named Billie Holiday sang, sitting there kicking it with Malcolm till the day came. Little Natasha show grown, tell a lady in the liquor store that she's forgiven. So come home, maybe in time you understand. Only God can save us when Miles Davis cutting loose with the band. Just think all the people that you knew in the past that passed on, they in heaven found peace at last. Picture a place that they exist together. There has to be a place better than this in heaven. So right before I sleep, dear God, wear a mask and remember this face. Save me a place in Thug's Mansion. Remember this face, save me a place in Thug's Mansion. Up in Thug's Mansion.
Before I get involved in anything nowadays, I have to straighten out my own position, and which is clear, I am not a racist in any form whatsoever. I don't believe in any form of racism. I don't believe in any form of discrimination or segregation. I believe in Islam. I'm a Muslim, and there's nothing wrong with being a Muslim. Nothing wrong with the religion of Islam. That just teaches us to believe in Allah as the God, and those of you who are Christians probably believe in the same God. Because I think you believe in the God who created the universe, and that's the one we believe in, the one who created the universe. The only difference being, you call him God, and we call him Allah. Jews call him Jehovah. If you could understand Hebrew, you'd probably call him Jehovah too. If you can understand Arabic, you probably call him Allah. But since the white man, your friend, took your language away from you during slavery, the only language you know is his language, you know, your friend's language. So you call him, you call for the same God he calls for. When he's putting a rope around your neck, you call for God and he calls for God.
Black man in America is in prison. He's born in prison. He's born a convict. He's born an inmate. And when we look upon the president of this country from the eyes of a people who are as if we were in prison, the president represents nothing but a warden to us, who is over us to tell us what we can do and what we can't do. Whereas to the white people in this country, he's a leader. He's an exponent of freedom, justice, and equality.
You can see between the black and the white, and you can think for yourself. You know when the man is telling the truth and when the man is telling the lie. No dropouts in our school. Nobody in our school with an inferiority complex. Knees knocking and head itching every time they see a white man. No, our little children who go to our school are taught to hold their head high, taught to throw their shoulders back, taught to stick their chest out. Am I right or wrong? Why you want those kind of lips? You want to look like a monkey. So much so you bleaching up, trying to get like the white man. The man taught you how to hate your hair. He taught you to hate your nose. He taught you to hate your mouth. He taught you to hate your skin. He taught you to hate yourself from your head to your feet. Now the white man is the greatest hate teacher that ever walked there.
And the names that are worn by black people in America are like names like Bunch, Powell, Murphy, Johnson. These are European names, and they don't fit us. These names were given to us during slavery by the slave master. And today, when we become Muslims and become followers of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, not only do we give up the Christian religion, but we also give back the slave master's name. Since we don't know what our own name would be today, we use X. X stands for the unknown.
We don't believe in segregation. We believe in separation. Marching on Washington will not solve the problems that are confronted by the black people in this country. That's number one. A society in which we can stand on our own feet and take care of ourselves as other intelligent people do.
Black people, brown people, red people, and yellow people gathered here from all over the world, from Africa.
They beat him. While he was laying on the ground with a bullet through his heart, they put a hole in his head with their club. They'd arrived early. As I told you earlier, even the policeman said, why should the ambulance hurry? There's nothing but niggers out there. Why, if some of you could hear or were aware of the conversation that the police engaged in concerning this event, I don't care how much anti-Muslim you might be, your own humane quality would make you resent with shame and their disgraceful behavior.
I've never at any time made any statement that anybody can even interpret to indicate that I believe in initiating acts of aggression or violence indiscriminately against people.
Oh. Salaam alaikum. Hold it.
Blood in my veins makes me the same. Wanna be a man.
All right, I guess we live now. Black power, black power, black nation. You're tuned in to In Defense of the People's weekly Tuesday night broadcast at 7 p.m. Central Standard Time, 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, People's Political Party, National Chairman Nat Turner, and your co-host, National Minister of Defense, Brother Motherland. Call in every Tuesday night, same black place, same black time at 845-277-9266. Again, that's 845-277-9266. Press the number one to participate. This is the People's Radio. Tonight's topic, a tribute to Malcolm X. We're going to open up the lines right now for our host, People's Political Party National Chairman, Nat Turner. Black Power, can you hear me, comrade?
Black Power Queen, right on, man. Tonight, we want to make this a especially good show, you know, for our listeners. You know, tribute to Malcolm X, who's also known to others as St. Omar Wiley, El Haj Malik El Shabazz, as a result of his transformation into the Sunni Orthodox Islamic belief system, due in part to his Hajj, the annual pilgrimage or trip that every Muslim should at least make once in his lifetime to the Islamic holy center of the world, Mecca, in the Arabian Peninsula. Tomorrow, you know, we have the day in between Malcolm's birthday, and so we thought this show would be only fitting that we do a tribute to the man that we know, that the world knows as Malcolm X, you know, who was born 1925, May 19th, in Omaha, Nebraska. You know, the fourth of seven children. His parents, you know, during that era, were Garveyites. They were proponents of Garveyism, promoters of it, and especially his father, you know, who had did considerable work for the UNIA. And so, you know, they had a huge family, you know, for those times, and developed, you know, problems due to the conditions of the Reconstruction Jim Crow era that reached its peak in the 60s. And Malcolm, as a child, due to the physical loss of his mother, in terms of what we understand today is emotional breakdown, psychological issues of being overwhelmed from the material conditions of being black in a racist environment, a racist classist environment. And so, you know, his mother was so-called admitted to what we can understand as a psychiatric ward. And even though years later, they were able to free their mother from such an institution. In the meantime, with the passing of his father at a young age, Malcolm families pretty much split up in the sense, which is the continual legacy of physical slavery, where our families were split up at the behest of the Europeans in their continual strategy of keeping their oppressed people off balance to the point where they could not retrieve themselves and gain their liberation. And we still experience this today with the so-called foster homes, which is what Malcolm was placed in, along with having to live with relatives after he had lost his father. He had moved around as a youth and to his early 20s. Boston, Michigan, and as a result of that, he had become known as a Detroit Red. There was also a Chicago Red, and that they had developed a relationship, you know, during those times, and Detroit Red had said that the funniest man he had ever met was Chicago Red. And this man later became known as Fred Sanford, who was the star of the show of the 30-minute sitcom referred to as Sanford the Son. And this Fred Sanford was the progenitor of today's modern comedian. Those who had followed him prior, Paul and all the rest of the comedians who had come along behind him. And Malcolm had also, in a stint in Boston, of course, Massachusetts, he went from there and ended up into the Harlem underworld. Where he was introduced to what the state refers to as criminal activities. And we understand these criminal activities as the bastard child or the bastard children of a decadent capitalism, which is no more nor less than the proprietorship of, in particularly, a handful of rich whites and their accomplices, or that we could understand as middle-class whites, and those who have become antagonistic in the sense as the so-called working labor class whites, the poor whites and the unemployed whites. And so as a result of that, people would have it much worse, which in turn would force them into a way of life based on the lack thereof, lack of material resources from a so-called legal perspective. And of course, at the time, dealing with the Jim Crow system, even white liberal bullshit. And so Malcolm paved his own way, indulged in pimping, was a hustler, dope pusher, a robber, indulged in racketeering, the numbers game. And those of us who've seen the movie Malcolm X, this is portrayed somewhat lengthy in the movie. And at one point, Malcolm had met his road dog, his comrade, his main man, who became known as Shorty, and also the figure known as West Indian Archie, who had introduced Malcolm into the Harlem underworld. As a result of that, Brother Malcolm ended up doing the bed, prison, 10 years serving the state, where it would say Malcolm X versus the people, which we understand is politically incorrect, and Malcolm X versus the state, the proprietors of the state, who had the nerve to criminalize Malcolm when they themselves were criminals in the larger, from a larger perspective. But unfortunately, a lot of us are not able to understand such language that I'm using. I've learned and known to understand that crime and politics go hand in glove, and that there could be no Frankenstein without a Dr. Frankenstein. While Malcolm had done this bid in prison, he had such a rebellious reputation against the religious order of the day, so much so that Malcolm had acquired a nickname, and his nickname was Satan. While in the prison system, Malcolm had met this brother, who he had commented on that was the only person that that could command a man's attention because of the things that he knew. And so this was the spark that began the road to Malcolm sort of recapturing his own life and winning this all life back into his own hands. Therefore, winning his humanity back, gaining his humanity from a system, from a culture, from a country, from a government, which claims to be humanistic and civilized, which is beyond laughter. It's a mere character of a comedy, in a sense. And so when there's a rehabilitation, Malcolm had a brother who would write him and further his understanding of himself as a black man, all the harmful effects of the culture, so much so that his brother had wrote him and told him to quit eating pork and stop smoking cigarettes and that he can free him from prison. And so Malcolm had been released, and was introduced to one Elijah Muhammad, formerly known as Elijah Poole, in the city of Chicago. And this is the late 50s that we're talking. And Malcolm continued to be taught and raised on his growth and awareness, growth and development under the tutelage of Elijah Muhammad, who had become the founder or leader of what is now known as the Nation of Islam, the NOI. And this particular brand of ideology, philosophy, or as some understand, religious views, which is a combination of things in particularly focusing on who the original man was, is, and has always been. And this was the cornerstone, we can say, that put Malcolm in a solidified state as a black man, being that Elijah Muhammad had espoused the view that the black man is the original man, and therefore that the black man is God, made in his three-dimensional image, owner, maker, shaper, creator, and fashion of all the worlds, who in the Arabic language is known as Allah. And so therefore, Malcolm's embracing of the Almighty, the Creator, the God that we have known in that language is Allah. And his antithesis, of course, his antipode, or his polemic at the other end of the stick, was the white man, the so-called white man, who Elijah Muhammad taught was the devil in physical form, an animated character, and that due to his nature, it was an irreconcilable difference between him and the original man, the black man. And so therefore, the Nation of Islam was of the view that since the white man is the devil, then the black man is his opposite. So therefore, they could not exist in the same place in peace and harmony due to the antagonistic ways and the nature of the so-called white man. And this Malcolm internalized very deeply, and by the early 60s, 62, Malcolm X had been speaking on different platforms, representing the Nation of Islam and being the voice for Elijah Muhammad, pretty much the second in command. And in the midst of that, Malcolm had built the Nation of Islam. He had expanded his numbers from several hundred to what some have concluded through their studies or investigation, as many as 75,000 members. But before Malcolm could fully extend himself or fully lay it all out on the line, there was another thing that Malcolm had to have gotten underneath his belt, because without it or without her, he couldn't have been the man that he was, the man that he still is today with us in spirit. And this is one Betty Sanders, who had met Malcolm on an occasion, and Malcolm would begin to invite her to trips to the museum or speaking engagements, at which they would begin to become closer. And Betty had joined the Nation of Islam, and she had changed her name to Betty X. And then 2 years later, her and Malcolm had got married. And as a result of that, they had 6 children. Four who had already been into the physical realm, moving in anatomical form, and twins who were on the way, who were in Betty's womb at the time that Malcolm X was being brutally assassinated by agents of the state who looked just like him. And so in the midst of that, as I said, Brother Malcolm, as some called him, he advanced the Nation of Islam. He had founded several mosques. Others he had expanded, such as the Mosque of Philadelphia. And later on, he was selected or chosen to lead the Mosque number 7 in Harlem, which he increased his membership drastically. There'd come a time when Malcolm had become the most fiery speaker, not only among black people or so-called black leadership, but in America during that time. It wasn't too long after 1962 that Malcolm's future in the Nation of Islam would last, in particularly what we're told or made to understand involving the assassination of John F. Kennedy. In 1963, and the comment that Malcolm supposedly made about the case with chickens coming home to roost, which media took and put its own slant, and a lot of persons in the media or known figures very critical of Malcolm, even Elijah Muhammad. Malcolm was just simply explaining that it was a case of the seeds that had been sown in this country, and that the source of the seeds, descendants, it would only turn and bite them in the ass at some point. And he was correct. But due to that, Malcolm, at the behest of Elijah Muhammad, suspended Malcolm for, I believe, 90 days. And this was only the beginning of the end. Stop right here. If we have any callers, do we have any callers?
Hello?
Black Power, we do have a caller calling from 504. 504, you live caller. Announce yourself.
Hey, how y'all doing? I don't know if y'all familiar with the search of the 3 missing children that was in the river. Found 2, but one is missing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yes, listen, Black Power Comrade, that's River Rat on the line. Yeah, they called me River Rat. But listen, man, I was speaking to one of y'all brothers, man. You know, coming from my background, I'm a white male. I'm about to be 50 years old, but during the time I was born, my mother couldn't afford to raise me, so I was raised by Black folks, you know. And I studied every heritage they had. I had to do everything. I was taught both sides. And in a situation, you know, I speak truth. I can't lie about nothing, you know. I was given an A in class for being on part of Black history, and I told him, I said, I didn't deserve that A. Give it away. I studied it. Listen, this is the thing that's going on with it, okay? I've been racially profiled for years. I never did nothing. I let it go because my wife is Black. My children are mixed. Matter of fact, I just had a baby born just yesterday morning, okay? And the thing about it is the three kids are my kinfolk. Two of them are my kinfolk. And, you know, I've been bashed. I've been called a coon hunter. I've been called what you call that, I'm looking for baby porch monkeys. Now I got to the point where people are threatening to kill me, and I'm just fine with me. But listen, man, the thing that I'm getting at with all this is, you know, we got enough hate in the world. You know, Black folks need to wake up and learn. You know, as a white man in this world, I learned one thing. White people can contradict everything you got going on in this world. The society is designed for them. And, you know, the struggle is that we got to fight to keep that. Because at the end, nothing is given to nobody. But the white man got everything for free. You see? And he's not going to share it with you because he don't want you with him. He want to keep his foot in your back. And when he keep his foot in your back, he want to hold you down and treat you like the slave. The thing that makes me mad is, you know, I'm not into that slave stuff. And for me, you know, I was talking to my brother Leon. Leon had opened my eyes to some things, and my eyes was already open. But just speaking with him, it kind of showed me that, you know, I have a voice. And as a white man, living in a house full of Black folks, didn't know what color I was. Because that's the way I was raised. I was taught both colors. The thing I'm getting at with this conversation is, you know, to have one thing, you know, people promised 40 acres and a mule, right? But if you pay attention, mm-hmm. The white man the fence line is already in your 40 acres. The minute you get 40 acres, you got to look at it. You're not giving 40 acres. Because at the end of the day, they're going to come up with shenanigans to make that 40 acres 9 acres. You feel what I'm saying? And me personally, I want to see everybody make it. But I want to see everybody have a fair share. Not behind his way, this way. We all have our own ways, you know. Without a voice being heard, nobody speaking for nobody, we can't get nowhere. You know, and the thing about it, you know, just today I had to go to my house, and it hurts me and it hurts my heart to be going to my house, people writing in love on my car. I'm sitting there. I'm really stressed out behind it. And I found myself in a situation where my son come to me. My son said, Daddy, what? I said, son, check this out. We all got a problem in this world, you know. And the thing that you got to look at in this world, son, you're a Black male. Even though your dad is white, but them folks don't want to see that. They're looking at you as a Black male in this world. And when you laid out in this world, son, you got three things against you when you walk out your door. Your skin color, your tone of talk, and your knowledge. You see, they already judge you by you being Black. You don't have no knowledge. But I taught my sons to speak on what's right. Don't hold back. Don't say nothing that's wrong. Because at the end of the day, if you don't speak, no one can speak for you. And so, you know, I basically laid out the guidelines. So we out there, we cleaning up the car. And so I said, Dad, you not mad? I said, no, son, I'm humble. Because I've been judged all my life. And I'm not going to give in to temptation. I'm not going to give in to the sinful world, bro. Because you got to look at it. Keep your head up. Threatening me? They threaten themselves, son, because they can't do me nothing. They can't do me nothing that this world ain't prepared for me to have. You know, and me, if anybody know me, they know one thing. I'll treat you with respect, but I also gonna demand respect. And then with that being said, it's like this. I sit back and I told people, and that's what bothers a lot of people about me when I made the comment. Y'all ain't really out here searching for these children, because if y'all was, y'all be tearing this war up. Y'all don't give a damn because these are poor project children that's not white color. And when I said that, well, you're white. I said, how do you know what I am? You see, you're looking at my outer shell. What's inside me? You know, your resource, everybody all on TV talking about they donated this, donated that. It ain't about what you donated. Why y'all, you know, why y'all claim to something that y'all didn't create? All y'all doing is sitting around smoking cigars, talking this, talking that. Now nobody went in war. Nobody went and tried to figure out a game plan. And that's what hurts me. But then when I sat back, I said, oh, now I know the answer. And Brother Leon was talking to me. And if you look at the live he did, I spoke straight from the heart. You know what I'm saying? Those are not white children. You're not going to get search and rescue help that you really need, because guess what? You're not that. You're not them. You know,
I'm going to cut you about, you know, you just the comments you're making, just a couple of things come to mind. Now you say you're a white Caucasian male, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Where we born and raised?
I couldn't hear you. What you said?
Where were you born and raised at?
I was born in Saratoga Springs, New York. My mother name was Pat. But when she couldn't afford to raise me, I was brought to New Orleans. And I was raised in the house by a black family.
All right. I'm just trying to, like, you know, because, you know, a lot of times, look at, you know, some of what you're saying, your experience, more time than I had something to do with demographics. You know, it's not a unique thing with you, but, you know, I've learned and understand in my lifetime, you know, if it's 10 white people in the room, okay, I would know, at least understand, that the law of nature would tell me, okay, at least one of them in the room, got to be decent. You know what I'm saying? So it becomes incumbent upon that one person, right?
Yeah.
It becomes incumbent upon that one person that, if that one person, you know, through the circumstances, conditions, interacts, you know, and becomes influenced with black culture or what have you, whatnot, stuff like that, and, you know, end up with a black partner, stuff like that, have some, you know, what they like to say, biracial children. Now, in this country, you said, you know, that it wasn't designed, you know, for black people. We clearly understand that. We, you know, those of us in political part, we clearly understand that we understand it's not. So, the question comes about liberation. You see what I'm saying? So if whatever white person embraces a reality that black people go through, then it becomes incumbent on that white person that's okay, well, look, you have a decision to make. So my question to you is, are you familiar or have you ever heard of John Brown before?
Yeah, I heard about him, and that's the name that was chosen, that was given to me, and I'm real comfortable with that, because at the end of the day,
okay.
You know, John Brown helped.
Yes. Okay. Now, look, this is my point. This is all I'm saying to you. And for the record, you know, this is a political assessment. Okay, this is no thing to brainwash you into something, some type of action. What I'm saying to you is, you know, there have been whites that have come along in the history of black people and try to make some kind of contribution. But, you know, because we understand, you know, liberalism, you know, the white liberals, and Malcolm X spoke about the white liberals, and some instances say the white liberals no different than the southern white. The only difference is that the southern white is out open with his shit, and the northern white liberals, they're more clandestine, the types like Joe Biden, Bill Clinton, you know, the so-called white Democrats that black people are going to go run to after some white Republican comes along from the far right and fleeces them. So it's due to a failure on the part of what's called black leadership. But I say to you, it's as simple as this. We reached the precipice. We reached the mountaintop of America's hegemony, and so therefore America's downfall, America's cataclysmic destruction. And so, what role you gonna play? Now you have black children. So it's very incumbent upon you now, you know what I'm saying, to make that sacrifice for your children. And so therefore, you have a decision to make yourself. You know what I'm saying? Like for me as an African, the great Frantz Fanon has said that every black man has a mission to fulfill. He can only do one or two things with it, whether he like it or not. He got a mission to fulfill. He can only do one or two things with it. He could fulfill it, or he could betray it. Now we understand, you know, this gross negligence about such terminologies, you know, a coon lover, nigger hunter, those kind of stuff. These terminologies that the white male seems to share, or these due to this survival of the fittest mentality that it has, referred to as social Darwinism, which places them in a predicament when it comes to miscegenation, blood mixing, or whatever you want to call it, because you know they're the slowest growing so-called race experiencing right now as we speak zero growth population. So therefore, the white ruling class, the thinkers, the intellects, those who push the button, those who operate and run things, is strategic on their part to practice genocide against black and brown people in order to slow our numbers down so they can have a living chance. In the meantime, you got these young white females chasing after these young black athletes who ain't no gonna be first round draft choices and top NFL number one pick and all this kind of shit, even some of these entertainers and actors and all these type of things. So this is what drives that. This is the blowback of the historical legacy of the relationship between black and white people. So we say to the good whites, get on your shit. You know what I'm saying? You know, get your tools, get what you're gonna work with, and set out on your mission. This world has to be a better place, and the whites have to deal with the whites, have to start with the whites. You know what I'm saying? If there's good whites, we say that the good whites more power to you. You know what I'm saying? You're afraid happy, you say, you know, to those good whites, you know, power to them too. But we understand that black people it's a necessity to have black power, because we're the most displaced group in this country besides what's left of the so-called Indian and what's referred to as the brown Latino community. So this is the predicament that the good whites will find themselves in. Black Lives Matter supporters, the wears the T-shirts, those who are flying flags in front of their houses, out there, you know, with cabinet signs. You know, we say that the buck don't stop there. That's just the beginning. And so it has to be escalation on the part of those whites. And I'm gonna tell you straight up, man, I'm a revolutionary. I'm a revolutionary straight out the gate. Something Malcolm X had said when he was in the Nation, and the little, you know, how he tried to portray the story, the little white student come to him and told Malcolm, "Well, you know, I'm one of the good whites. You know, I'm not one of the bad devils. How can I help?" And Malcolm told her, "How can he said, "What can I do?" She said, "Nothing." Later on, as an expansion, when he became internationalized, he looked at the picture on a much broader scale. You know what I'm saying? So we've seen the struggle, different people struggling around the world, right? So he said if he had to do all over again, he'd tell her, and I'm going to end with this right here, you know, go back and start with your parents. You see? So this biracial thing, you know, of course, it places the children in quite a predicament. You know, at some point in time, you know, if you look at it, the parents got a choice to make. The children say, "Look, my black side catch a hell." And so we said, "Well, I'm biracial." I said, "Well, look, let me ask you, can your white side get you into that private country club? Can your white side get you into the these secret clandestine organizations that plan the destruction of black and brown people around the world? And if so, you infiltrate it, and then you handle your business. You have to handle your business." And so that's my commentary or response to your experience, what have you. But like I say, you know, the shit is real as steel, man. It's real as steel. You know what I'm saying? It's nothing to really prove to black people. You, as a white male, you got to prove that to yourself. You got to prove that to yourself.
That's what I'm saying. I proved that to myself.
It's revolution. It's a revolutionary mentality, attitude as a so-called good white. As a so-called good white. No disintegrations. No disintegration at all. Don't say, but black people must be in control of their own destiny. So that's why we say, you know, Garveyism, you know, Marcus Garvey. You see what I'm saying? But I just wanted to, you know, get this call in, but I want to continue, this tribute to Malcolm X. And so, you know, we get more calls as we go, because, you know, sometimes these shows be so much, you know, it'll go by in a flash. But, you know, appreciate the call. You know what I'm saying? Appreciate the call. You know what I'm saying? No doubt. You know what I'm saying? But so do we have another call, Conrad?
Black Power, no, we don't, gentlemen. Go as you will.
Okay. Well, look, let me, I want to do this, you know, the second piece, you know, the second half of my mouth. So as I said, you know, his comments, you know, about the relationship to the John F. Kennedy assassination, you know, which is the perception that we're given, which was pretty much the beginning of the end of Malcolm X's, you know, days, you know, with the Nation of Islam. You understand what I'm saying? And in the midst of that, you know, Malcolm had learned some things, you know, about Elijah Muhammad, you know, due to his being trained by the man, even so much so as, you know, as a father figure. I was told by this elder, who you know, who used to you know, roll with me, so to speak, embrace me as an older brother, and he said that, you know, he come up, you know, sort of like Nation of Islam links, you know, and you know, he said that they had referred to Malcolm X as the Lamb, you know, but which is a reference also in the Bible to Jesus, you know, but some of these things they learned, you know, about like now, of course, you know, like behind was fathering, you know, these children by, you know, young women, and Malcolm believed that the real and true intentions behind the you know, the rip, the split, or the feelings toward him, or Malcolm's rise being you know, you know, rug being pulled from underneath him, so to speak, you know, if I will, you know, due to the fact that we had learned, you know, Elijah Muhammad, when he fell one in, you know, he was teaching, you know, the brothers, you know, to be monogamous, and, you know, he was fathering, you know, multiple children. And that's one of the things that's, you know, up in there, in that mix, with Malcolm X, his breaking away from Nation of Islam. But you know, when Malcolm had left the you know, the Nation of Islam, there were a number of people who also defected with him, you know, and because they really believed on him, and according to them, they said that Malcolm was the truth, and that there was a lot of internal jealousy or envy or whatever you want to call it, you know, and you know, that, you know, precipitated a lot of things later on, you know, which the state took, as we can say, was an anthill that may have grown into a slight mound, and of course the state took it and turned it into Mount Kilimanjaro, you know what I'm saying, with his assassination. But after Malcolm left, you know, he traveled, and in the midst of that, he had started his own organization or formation, you know, as a Muslim Mosque Incorporated. And, of course, you know, his trips to the so-called Middle East or the Near East and North Africa or in parts of Africa. And he had learned to internationalize the struggle, the plight of black people in America. He had taken it beyond, you know, the borders of America to expose the hypocrisy of America, condemning other countries, even fighting these wars in Vietnam, you know, claiming to, as they still do today, you know, trying to, you know, bring democracy to an oppressed people, you know, to people who had been ruled under a regime, under some despotic ruler, who had mistreated his fellow countrymen, you know. And Malcolm was very, very, very intelligent, very keen, and very, you know, well understood. And of course, that began, of course, when he was in you know, being held POW, prisoner of war, and you know, the account where he said to have read the, you know, the standard dictionary from front to back, you know, and he learned all the words and stuff like that. You know, you begin to understand these terminologies about, you know, the color black being bad and the color white, you know, is good. The white ain't the good angel is white. The black angel is black, or what have not. You know, black ball. You know, Black List, you know, Black Sunday, you know, Black Monday, you know, like we had right before, you know, these holidays, you know, you know what I'm saying? But he understood those things. And but in the midst of his expansion, like I said, you know, one account when he was in Africa, and Spike Lee tries to portray this in the movie, you know, when he was in Africa, and he had this companion with. Whose name escapes me right now, but his companion looked like he could, you know, he's like a light-skinned Egyptian, you know, curly hair. And he rode with Malcolm wherever he went, you know, when he was over there, you know, he was like his international, you know, road dog, so to speak. And one occasion, Malcolm was poisoned, and he believed and understood that, it was the CIA. It was the international arm of his government. You know, and even his autobiography, he speaks about wherever he went, he noticed the same two white men, you know, who had followed him wherever he went. And so Spike, he tried to, a snippet. And some of us felt that Spike Lee should have put more emphasis in the movie of that. It should have been more time spent, you know, portraying that than just a little, you know, little flash of these two white men, you know, when he was visiting the pyramids and stuff, you know. He had also understood the international interests of the United States, the international policy of the United States, and therefore his international policy was, of course, based on solely on, you know, natural resources. And so it is during this time, around the same time, where you had the Anglo-American establishment, you know, who had penetrated into the so-called Near East, the Middle East, in the 50s, you know. You know, the Anglo oil company, one of the Anglo oil companies, which is now known today as British Petroleum. And so he had learned that. He learned that this concept about where Jesse Jackson's and some of the other Negro activists, you had to hit them where it hurts, in their pocketbook, you know. And so Malcolm had already beat them to that. He'd already realized that. And so he had been visiting these countries that were natural resource rich, and just so happened to be that Malcolm was a Muslim. Of course, you know, as I said, he had made his Hajj, took part in the perambulations around the Kaaba shrine seven times, and all of the symbolic festivities that goes along with that. And so these countries that he was visiting were these same countries where the leaders were also Muslims. And so this is what sent the shock through the American government. This is what really, you know, struck them fear-wise. You know, so he had really drew that rat. You know, he really drew that rat. And some people, you know, get the impression that, you know, Malcolm, you know, he was, you know, was so used to hearing Malcolm talk about the white man, but that, it was much more broader aspect to his assassination than just that. But it was when he internationalized the struggle in the hopes of in the near future going to the UN before the UN Council and ringing up their own international laws and placing the American government on trial, reference to human rights violation, the same violation that been accusing other countries of. You see? And so He would sit with the prince of Saudi Arabia, Ibn Saud, you know, who's named at the Arabian Peninsula. Saudi Arabia is named after, you know, part of the Arabian Peninsula. And so, you know, he'd understood that. And so Malcolm is holding an audience with, you know, the crown of the, you know, the proprietor of the resource-rich oil reserves of Arabia, and America is trying to, the Anglo-American establishment is that's what they're after, and Malcolm is going to influence, you know, him to cut them off, you know, and this was his strategy. This was the strategy, you know, that he developed. And in the midst of that, when he came back, he'd also familiarized himself with the, you know, the African Union, you know, the Organization of the African Union, you know, the Pan-Africanist idea that Garvey had also been instrumental in shaping up to Malcolm's time, you know, that had been bequeathed to that generation. And so Malcolm, you know, he dabbled in that, and he got a firsthand look at that. Such figures as Kwame Nkrumah, a number of the Jewish Inyeri, Sekou Touré, who part of whose name had become the whole name of formerly known as Stokely Carmichael, known himself as Kwame Touré. You know, taking name from Kwame Nkrumah and Sekou Touré, and that's how he, you know, develops his African name, you know, and developed the All African People's Revolutionary Party, you know. But Malcolm had, you know, took notes. He understood it. So he began to draw the connection between the struggle of black people in America and on the African continent and during the same time also. And man, listen, I'm talking about, This is the part here that could really, really, speaking personally, it angers me. In the same period, Africa, in a sense, was on fire. You know, it were revolutions that were taking place on the continent simultaneously, and even in Cuba, when Castro and the great revolutionary genius Che Guevara, you know, when they teamed up and overthrew the Batista regime in Cuba, the U.S. CIA-backed Batista regime, brutal regime, the same brutal regime that they could ignore in Cuba, but they somehow could see it in Vietnam or give the impression to the American people around the country, even in Korea, you know, and it was simply about, you know, imperial colonies. You know, and today we have that debate. Biden has the nerve to chide Russia for what they're doing to Ukraine, but seems to catch selective amnesia when it comes to Saudi Arabia doing to the black people in Yemen what Putin is just now starting to do. You see, so it's the same hustle. You know, and so this is a Hegelian type moves. You know, you left one minute, you know, it's this thing with Iran and Iraq, you know, going back and forth. And so, you know, Malcolm saw that. He saw these things, but he was able to take advantage of understanding the imperial whims of the American government, you know, which had began to expand itself into an empire. You know, he had his ambitions after World War II to come up on the hills of the British Empire and continue, you know, the rule, white world capitalist rule over black and brown peoples of the earth and dominate earth's natural resources through their material ambitions in these European countries. You see? And so, so when Malcolm came back, he set up the Organization of Afro-American Unity. And his expansion and his knowledge base, of course, you know, Spike Lee, you know, portraying the part or the scene where Malcolm, he speaks about it in his autobiography, where he talks about, you know he, as he was there, you know, taking part in the Hajj and, you know, doing the Salat, you know, there were pale-skinned, blue-eyed Muslims that were there. And they were all one brotherhood, you know, eating out the same, you know, bowl and passing the same, you know, drinking vessel, whatever, you know. And so we come back as expanded, an expansion in his understanding, he's internationalized. And this is where some black consciousness individuals try to pounce upon opportunity to, you know, ridicule him, to attack his ideology and that he was walking contradiction. But they failed to understand and they failed to see his continued growth and development on an international scale, which naturally takes on a wider range or expansive view when it comes to capitalism, white European rule, you see. And so we were speaking about the Vietnamese cause and how the Vietnamese started off, what he said, with bows and arrows. And by the time they finished, they had their own shit, pushing the helicopters into the Mekong River. He referred to them as a bunch of rice eaters. You know, he spoke about, the Algerian Revolution. But he talks about the FLN, you know, who developed into a group due to the relationship, due to the irreconcilable difference with the French, you know, who had come there in the 1830s, violently took it over, you know, killed men, women, and children in the name of being a civilized nation and had confiscated North Africa. Okay, and it took the Algerian people 120 years to come out from underneath French domination, French rule, the French confiscation by a small minority of people over a huge Muslim population. You know, and so the Algerian Revolution was taking place in Cuba. Revolution was taking place in West Africa, Cabo Verde, Guinea-Bissau, you know, on the west coast of Africa under the great Milka Cabral. And so Malcolm, he sees the opportunity, you know, just like Bobby Seale said, he wrote a book called Seize the Time. You know, so he sees an opportunity, you know, to take advantage, you know, of the Europeans' faux pas, and of course, you know, the highest stage of capitalism is imperialism / neocolonialism, which is what we had today, but it's the highest stage. So history is clearly showing and proving, you know, that Malcolm is clearly right, and so the writing is on the wall. It's clearly on the wall, contrary to what anyone of these talking here say, and even some maybe black conscious or whatever. It's not no personal thing. It's a historical fact. It's a historical fact that the highest stage of capitalism is imperialism. And so we've seen those were the vestiges of the beginning of his end. You know, the writing's on the wall. And so Africa was on fire. Malcolm take this energy back to America under the Organization of Afro-American Unity, based, as I said, on the African Union and the development of a pan-African state, what Kwame Nkrumah's talking about, you know, the federated 50 states of Africa, you know, and we all want in a diverse range of black and brown people. And, of course, you know, with the Muslims been through with the Anglo-American standard, and that, of course, that we know is partially what can be considered a racial thing, but at the same time, it's a religious antagonism between one group of people who profess one thing and another group of people who profess another thing, and then the Christians referring to the Muslims as pagan and whatever, and the Muslims in return referring to the Christians as unbelievers and infidels. You know, so this is in the midst of this period that was brewing in the late 50s and the 60s. And, of course, the Algerian people won their liberation. And even in Zimbabwe, you know, and the Congo with Patrice Lumumba. But Patrice Lumumba dissed the Belgian, this Belgian royalty, you know, 40 years old, same age as Malcolm, you know, when he was murdered, you know, around that age. You know, so these are the people that Malcolm was trying to familiarize the people with in America and get them to understand that it's a battle for our human rights, and civil rights go under human rights. You can't place civil rights over human rights, because how could you have one without the other? You see what I'm saying? So in the midst of that, Malcolm had became critical, you know, of what, you know, he referred to as the Big Six, you know. And, of course, you know, this Big Six, Martin Luther King, A. Philip Randolph, John Lewis, Roy Williams, Whitney Young, and James Farmer. You know, so therefore he talked about the, you know, the farce on Washington, how the Kennedys had made phone calls and rallied the Negro leadership up and told them to get ahead of it, you know, put a face to it, you know, less the Black Power virus that was going around, you know, began to, you know, tear shit up, you know, the same violence visited upon them that they had used to get the descendants, ancestors in the condition that they were in, you know, using the force of violence. And, of course, you know, Malcolm, when he talked about, you know, he spoke about violence, you know, he was very critical, you know, of nonviolence and how could one be nonviolent with a people who are violent towards us on the daily basis, and that violence was their common language since day one. And even to the point where he said, you know, we know in so many ways, you know, where the white man, you know, was their belief system, the understanding system about how the white man was created, and that the white man was banished to the Caucasus Mountains, and he spilled out, you know, and since that day and time he had spread around, and everywhere he went, you know, he was violent with all the people that they came in contact with, who was already on these lands before them, you know, India, Iran, Iraq, you know, what is now known as Turkey, you know, North West Asia, which is pretty much, you know, connects, you know, what they refer to as continental Europe, you know, Arabia, you know, Jordan, Syria, you know, that part of the world. Well, all these Black and brown indigenous people who were the people that built those civilizations, who you still, you know, with these ruins and monuments that still exist there today, you know. And, of course, you know, North Africa, you know, ancient so-called Egyptian civilization. And so he was teaching history, not himself, at the same time. And he was getting the Black men to really understand who he was in order, you know, to take back his humanity. You know, and of course the Black Panther Party piggybacked on that, you know, and here the, you know, the Black pride, you know, Black love, you know, with the asshole, you know, a reclamation of our Black selves, you know, self-worth, self-esteem, and especially Black women, you know, from the abuse of the slave trade, you know, the physical slavery, reconstruction, you know, the Jim Crow, and Malcolm spoke about, you know, the Black woman. And how, you know, the Black woman must be defended, you know, at all costs. And, of course, in the Nation of Islam, I was told this personally by a sister who had been in the Nation. She had told me that the brothers, you know, they had roles, they had certain teams that did certain things, you know, certain kinds of certain teams that had took care of certain business, you know, and how some of these brothers are putting their hands on these sisters, you know, and these brothers, you know, they wore ski masks. And, you know, they went out, you know, they were supposed to came back and that was it. You know, nigga wasn't putting his hand on a woman no more. You know, but, you know, he talked about all of that. You know, but he was very critical, again, you know, of this flawed leadership. And, of course, you know, Organization for Afro-American Unity, you know, his expansion. And as I mentioned about the, you know, he said he could have it all over again, you know, with the little young white female student, you know, who came up to him and said, you know, she's one of the good whites, you know, how can I help this, that, and other, what can I do? You know, he said, you told her to go back and start with your parents, you know. But again, you know, there are those who, you know, try to take, Malcolm, you know, he betrayed the Black, this, the Black, that, you know, but Malcolm never strayed from Black power. You know, self-sustainability. He never strayed from that. What he did was he made the white man's problems more complex than they had been. And that was strategic. It was a strategy. And some of us missed that boat. Well, some of us missed that boat. Do we have any more call to comrades? Can you hear me? I don't know if y'all can hear me, but I can't hear if you respond to me.
Black Power Comrade.
Black Power.
My phone was
there. We go.
My bad. We don't have any callers, but the switch is lit up. We do have callers that's on listening, but nobody actually pressed one.
Okay,
we just
cool,
want
right
to remind y'all every Tuesday night to call in at 845-277-9266. And press one to participate. Like I said, this is the People's Radio, Black Power.
Yeah, right on. Yeah, so, it's strategy, you know, and that was the writing on the wall, you know, that the Europeans like to say, that they eventually would have to do because, you know, the type of person he was and his spiritual foundation and his path. It was unshakable. You know, just saying about everybody has a price. Well, Malcolm proved them wrong. He contradicted them. He proved them wrong. He was unviable. Like some of the other civil rights leadership. You know, money was going around. He was unviable. So much so to the point when they thought they could take advantage of the split between him and Elijah Muhammad. And so what did the FBI do? They thought they could go pay him a visit. You know, thought they can sit down and have a civil, man-to-man, you know, humanistic conversation, dialogue. And what did Malcolm do? Malcolm beat him to the punch. He knew that he knew what they was there for. So what did he do? He planted a recording device in his house. And you can go online and listen to the conversation. And what is the chief thing that they're trying to do? Trying to drive a wedge, so therefore, you know, you can find the string to pull and escalate the breakup or the split between Malcolm and Elijah. And so they're asking him questions about Elijah Muhammad. He said, well, you're going to have to ask Elijah that question. Speak for him. He's grown and speak for himself, you know. And he said, well, you know, I think he told him 2 points. Well, I think it was rather insulting to my intelligence for you to come here and think you can ask me a question or try to, you know, slick me into some answers or giving up information, whatever, you know. You knew what they were there for, you know. So that was it. When they left that defeated. They left that it was humiliated. Their high intellectual IQ capacity was demolished. It was wounded. And the white man has the so-called white man has this thing about his superior intellect, so much so that he had when he went into Africa. The so-called scramble for Africa when they met in the Berlin Conference in 1884-85, and how he took them out and called them Africa among themselves. And they went in there and they said that they were bringing civilization to the Africans, to the primitives, to the pagans. You know, the three C's, civilization, commerce, and capitalism. No, Christianity, you know. And so, you know, he defeated them. And so there's a file, you know, a file the size of an encyclopedia. That they had on Malcolm, that they kept on Malcolm, you know? And you go through the file and you see all these things about this man. Yeah. And they were clearly afraid of him in every sense of the word. In every sense of the word. You know, so his assassination had to be brought about some kind of way. And his assassination is sort of similar like, you know, Chairman Fred, you know, the deputy chairman in the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party. You know, it's similar to his. And, of course, you know, Chairman Fred in the movie Judas and the Black Messiah, with a scene where they show him in the dark in the room where he's, you know, leaning up against the dresser or whatever you want to call it. And he has a little pad and a pen. He's pacing back and forth, and he's, you know, he's practicing, like he's practicing for a speech. He's saying, he's repeating these things. He's quoting Malcolm. He's internalizing Malcolm right there. That's a scene right there to show you the type of effect that Malcolm had. And, of course, the Black Panther Party, some circles refer to the Black Panther Party as the sons and daughters of Malcolm X or the children of Malcolm X. You know what I'm saying? And was how effective he was. And so again, you know, his demise had to be schemed up some kind of way. You know, and so that found a way to do it by attempting to escalate the you know, the breakup of Malcolm's leaving the Nation of Islam. And, of course, you know, you have a lot of young people who are vulnerable and susceptible to emotional rants, disappointment, hurt. And so they pounced upon, they seized the time, they exploited those weaknesses, you know. They exploited those weaknesses. And there was even a time where the FBI had an art division. As strange as that sounds, the FBI had an art division, and they would, you know, take these artists, and these artists would draw these characters, you know, and of course they had great plagiarizers, you know, persons who went to school to stenography, you know, this art of writing, you know, where they, you know, if they wanted to, they could have been forging checks and getting away with them, you know, licking people's signatures. And so this is what they were doing. You know, they would write you a letter and you know, put Elijah, make you think it was coming from Elijah Muhammad, and then vice versa. They would write a letter, make Elijah Muhammad think it was coming from Malcolm X. You know, so these are the tactics that they would use in the counterintelligence program, because Jacob Hoover told them the sky's the limit. The sky's the limit. Whatever you come up with, whatever you could devise, you know, boom, you know, let's have it. And so these were some of the things. And of course, you know, there were a number of incidences besides him being poisoned, attempt on the life when he was in overseas. Incident where you were running with the Nation of Islam cats, you know, in Harlem. One time he was coming out of a hotel. Another instance where Malcolm had arranged a flight, a trip to go speak. I forget which city he was supposed to be going to speak, but anyway, the brother who had became his road dog in the States had said that one time they were downtown, they were running. Another time, you know, they were running late, that so they jumped in the cab, you know, to catch a flight. And the cab driver, you know, the usual route they would take to get to the airport. And so this particular cab driver had made an unusual turn. I mean, it was a right turn, but he turned, and he said, you know, the airport's that way, you know. And so the brother, he said he always wore a trench coat, and he kept a pistol in it everywhere he went with Malcolm. And so this brother, say, pulled the pistol out, you know, put the pistol to the cab driver, he told him, look, you know, pull this cab, we'll blow your brains out, you know, whatever, you're dead, man. And so they you know, they thwarted that one, you know, attempt on his life right there, you know. So it was just that one time. Yeah, good. Okay, yeah, let him in. Call, tell us who your name, where you calling from, which question or comment.
Yo, Black Power's brother Cat Tears the Deep. What's going on, comrade?
Right on, man. Black Power T, man. What's going on with you?
Oh, man, I'm good, brother, man. I'm good, Chairman. I'm good. What's going on with you, brother Motherland? I heard Sister Army, the Queen Army, the Black Power Sister Queen. Man, I just want to say Black Power family, you know, anytime we get to pay tribute to our great ancestor, man, you know, I almost missed y'all. You know what I'm saying? Because I didn't work tonight. You know what I'm saying? Usually I'll get off work and I'll get on, but since I didn't work tonight, I'm a little comfortable over here. You know what I'm saying? And I'm going through some research and I say, oh, shit, I said the show is on. You know what I'm saying? I'm gone. Mm-hmm. So I want to apologize. Mm-hmm. I didn't get to hear Chairman Nat's tribute, but I know that it was powerful. And I really want to apologize. It was my intention to listen fully through tonight. But what I do want to do is I just want to, y'all know I'm always going to bring some kind of, you know, source knowledge. I just want to read a little bit from the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, The Fall of America. You know, I just want to kind of tie in some of these themes because, you know, a brother like me, you know, young brother, you know, when I came into the movement, a lot of my primary knowledge, first and foremost, was Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, like in that aura of knowledge, the NOI, mm-hmm. the Nation of Islam, you know what I'm saying? So I just want to go with this for a second here. And it's a book called The Fall of America. So for everybody listening here tonight, I'm just going to drop it on you. Go get the book, The Fall of America, by the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And then just quickly, I want to also quote from the Handbook of Revolutionary Warfare by Kwame Nkrumah. And the reason why is because at that time, and you can touch on this a little bit if you want to, Nat, but at that time, you know, there was revolution here in America, there's revolution in Africa, and Kwame Nkrumah mm-hmm. ends up being one of those premier figures, and him and Malcolm had a relationship. So I just wanted to quote really quick from The Fall of America in the Handbook of Revolutionary Warfare, Black Power. So in chapter 40 of The Fall of America on page 170, the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad writes, "It is useless for you to try to prevent the fall of the white man's world. He says there is no checking it. The white race has not tried to do the right thing. Justice, the doing of justice would have checked her fall." The Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad says, "But America was never willing, and even at this hour, she is not willing to do justice by those whom she has mistreated." He continues on to say that she has dealt injustice to her black once slave for the nearly 500 years that she has been in the Western Hemisphere. He goes before that chapter in chapter 14 on page 61, and he says, he talks about the high positions they offer to the house niggas. He says they offer high positions and money to the so-called Negro intellectual politician who will work against the good of the people. They will accept such gratuity, for they have been deprived of love and self and kind. He says further on page 39 in chapter 9, he says, "America is a country." The Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad was one of the teachers that first primary source of knowledge for Brother Malcolm, you know, and I like to go back and kind of see where some of those earlier ideas came from. So the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad says in the book, The Fall of America, on page 39 in chapter 9, he says, "America is a country where evil is dominant, and the people in America think nothing but evil." He says it is very seldom that you can talk to a person without getting the thought quickly that their mind is filled with evil. He says on page 47, on chapter 11, he says, "Our future is at stake, and 99% of us do not know it. With ever evil snoopers and those seeking an excuse to do their worst to you makes it hard for the 99% ignorant to ever know the truth." He says they claim the truth to be subversive and hate teachings. They seek any kind of charge to place against us to get revenge for our preaching the truth. They tap our telephones, eavesdrop, and follow us around from place to place, and use tape recording machines, and the hypocrites and the stool pigeons amongst us keep them up to date on what we say and do. Finally, the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, on the topic of course, the counterintelligence program at the time, he says they are bold enough, my God, to even ask your own kin, your own relative, to help them do you evil and do and put fear and ignorance on the part of our poor people, the enemies of them, and then they destroy themselves. And that is what the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad says in The Fall of America. But I wanted to read that part because it's right on point to what Nat was saying about counterintelligence. And I want to end on this note here. And I would love if you could kind of, and I guess that could be my going away point. If you can kind of tie that relationship, and maybe not even the relationship so far as Kwame Nkrumah and Malcolm, but just that atmosphere, that temperature. There was rumbling in the jungles of Africa, rumbling in the jungles of America, and it was happening at the same time. So Kwame Nkrumah says in the Handbook of Revolutionary Warfare, I read it so passionately, comrades, because we know what it means to us, right? He says, "If the liberation movement is firmly established, the colonial powers resort to a containment policy." What is a containment policy, fam? The honorable, long-standing legend of Black Power, Kwame Nkrumah, he says that in order to stop any further progress and to deaden its impact, to achieve the objective of a containment policy, the colonial power uses its arsenal of alliances, its network of military bases, economic devices such as corruption, sabotage, blackmail. And he says, equally just as insidious, the psychological weapon of propaganda with the view of impressing on the masses imperialist dogmas, and he goes on to mention a few of those dogmas, one being that the capitalist free enterprise is the only way to live in this world. So I say that I read, you know, those points to kind of give some type of a view into what, you know, that mind state of nationalism, where does it come from? Some of those primary teachers, those sources who walked at that time, who we still look today for, who we still look to today for knowledge. And I want to thank the People's Political Party, National Chairman Brother Nat Turner, the National Minister of Communication, Sister Amina, the National Minister of Defense, Brother Mother. I just want to thank you, comrades, and thank you, nationalists, for continuing to politically educate the people. I want to give thanks and just say how much we love our ancestor, Brother Malcolm. It really is a love, you know, that you just can't put in words, and how much we sit and think and go over and over on the legacy and how much still must be done today. You know, I say to you, comrades, you huru, Black Power, and I'm still listening in and tuned into the show, Black Power family.
Yeah, right on. What I was saying was, that's the part you missed. I just was talking about, I had said that, and let's not forget that we got to remember, during that period, you know, Africa was on fire, you know, and Malcolm seized the opportunity, he pounced on it, and he connected the struggle with Black people in America with the struggle in Africa and the liberation struggle there. In other words, you know, if Africa ain't free, we ain't free. If we ain't free, Africa ain't free. And so he was politicizing the people in America. He was keeping them abreast of what was going on there. And by the way, some years later, on into the 70s, Henry Kissinger wrote up a couple of memorandums. One of them is Memorandum 200, and I think the other one is Memorandum 46. Now, I think it's Memorandum 46 that specifically states that it is incumbent on the part of the U.S. government and its tentacles, the FBI, and its international arm, the CIA, to prevent the unity or the collaboration of the Black liberation struggle, the Black power movement in America and Africa from tying its, sort of laces together, you know, tying in their ends together with one another. And that's Memorandum 46, if I can remember. If you're interested, you can be able to type Memorandum 46, Henry Kissinger, K-I-S-S-I-N-G-E-R. You know, who was a white Jew who had served tremendously in a number of administrations. And he was around during the Johnson era, the Nixon era, you know. And so, but it's Memorandum 46 as a result of the great Malcolm X, who was internationalizing the struggle, which the Black Panther Party had, took the mantle, the baton, so to speak, and kept it going. With Malcolm X, by the way, Malcolm had developed a relationship with Robert Williams, you know, the elder who initially, in a sense, developed the what we call today the gun club, the Black gun club, due to the one-time savagery on the part of these civilized Christians in the South, and particularly in Carolina. And so Malcolm had been doing these fundraisers for Robert Williams, you know, to get guns, you know, because he was training the brothers and sisters there, and in particular the sisters, the women, because he was well aware of the fact that the Black men had to go out and make a living for their families, which would leave their women at home and vulnerable with their children. You see, but it was due to that. It was due to that and his legacy and what he did, you see. But, you know, his assassination, at which point we are at now. Of course, we know right before his assassination, his house was firebombed. And that picture that was taken of him peering out of the window, out behind the curtain, with that thing in his hand. You see, and in his autobiography, of course, in collaboration with Alex Haley, same historian and writer that wrote the book Ruth, which was turned into a movie. He spoke about when it came to the problems that he was developing, the serious nature of it, and he's in a sense asking him who you think's behind. And he had said that, well, he knew that the Nation of Islam didn't have such capabilities because he the one that trained them, so he knew their limitations. So he clearly said that it was the CIA. So he was very well aware of what was taking place. He was very well aware of what was taking place. You know, now he may have realized the odds of him surviving it, but he accepted it if he did. He accepted it, you know. So he made the ultimate sacrifice. And so those of us today, we're only kidding ourselves. We're only bullshitting ourselves. We think we ain't going to make those same sacrifices today. You know, and claim we revolutionaries, claim we militants, and all the rest of those things. And there's no disrespect, and there's no shot or subliminal message or subtle message at nobody. It must be said, including myself, you know, as chairman of the People's Political Party. You see, and I accept it. But that must be said. But, yeah, you know, he made the ultimate sacrifice. You know, so his assassination on February 21st, 1965. You know, there's a number of factors that were involved. It's not as so easy, it's so monolithic. There's a book called The Judas Factor, you know, that talks about some things that even some of these talking heads today, when they speak about Malcolm, they're going to be trying to speak about Malcolm in a couple of days, you know, in the universities, you know. Who fail to acknowledge certain things due to their ties to the establishment via the institution, you know. But it's a number of things, you know. And, of course, you know, on that day, one of the things that was clearly pointed out was that where was the security at that day when at times before they had security there. And, of course, the day before his assassination, they were given a dance, you know, at the Ottoman ballroom. And, of course, it was said that, you know, the perpetrators had did a trial run, you know, a dry run or whatever you want to call it, you know, where, you know, get your hands out of my pocket, nigga, kind of thing, you know. It would also remind you of the passes that were used to murder Kennedy and Martin Luther King, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald and James Earl Ray, okay? Even the patsy James Wilkes Booth or whatever his name is, who we're told assassinated Abraham Lincoln. And so there's similar patterns here, you see. One of the sisters who had left with Malcolm X had clearly stated some years later, used to be a show, you know, a talk show would have guests like you see today, you know, the elder named Gil Noble, you know, he had a talk show back then. He would bring on, you know, these certain political figures and whatnot. And years later, he had managed to get a hold of these remaining individuals who were close with Malcolm. It was a number of one or two of his so-called bodyguards, one or two sisters who had left with him. But one sister clearly stated that when he asked her why she had left, she said, why did she leave with Malcolm? She said, because he was the truth. And everybody knew it. Everybody knew it. He was the truth. It's who he was, you know, and it was simple as that. She said she didn't hesitate. And they knew that was it. They knew that was the writing on the wall, you know. So it was a lot of internal is because of that, who he was. And these brothers claiming that they're Muslims and you know, doing the salat, bowing down to Allah, had the nerve, you know, to say that they were Muslim. They weren't Muslim. They were fake Muslims. She said it clear. And when he asked her, where were you on that? She said, I was there. She said, I was sitting up in there. And when the shoot started happening, I whipped my shoes off to go up there, run up there to the front. And the brother grabbed me and tried to cut me. And I told the brother, brother, you know, let me turn me loose. You know, and she ran up there and she went to go, you know, told the brother who had the, no, don't shoot him in the leg. Give me the pistol. You know, shoot him in his head. Yeah, and she was clear on that. But something else she pointed out. She pointed out something else. There's an overhang up at the top. If you're standing on the stage facing the audience, there's this overhead up where if you were filming, this is where the camera people would get, you know, to set up their, you know, to film like a broadcast or whatever. And she pointed that out. And she said it was something else that got her attention. And she said they had individuals up in that overhang up there. You know, she pointed that out. And I heard this ex-FBI agent, so-called black FBI agent, who had been, you know, in the agency, and because of the treatment, in other words, they reminded him that he was still a nigger, no matter how much he tried to, you know, fit in and serve his country, you know, from the bad guy and all this kind of shit or whatever, you know. And so due to that, I mean, you know, he walked away from it. And of course, there's all, you know, well, not always, but there's these times when people walk away from an organization or a group, you know, they air their dirty laundry, they come out against them or, you know, expose hidden things or, you know, so this particular cat, I can't think of his name, but he's going around speaking at some point. And I think this same brother, as a matter of fact, had started kind of teaming up with Minister Farrakhan some years ago, you know, but he had started giving these speeches, going around speaking, and he had brought up the assassination of Malcolm X. And he had pointed out the same thing about the FBI were up above this overhang, you know, while the shooting was going on. And he had said that the angle of the bullets, Malcolm's wound, showed that they'd come from an upward angle. And this is this overhang that he's talking about here. You know, I just wanted to mention that for the record, but it's a sister who was with Malcolm in there, and she had said something that she knew, and it was something about this over there. They had persons up there. She knew that, you know, because like I said, you know, no security, none of that stuff like that. Of course, you know, Malcolm sent his guy who would normally have been there with him on a errand or something, like just to, you know, some people say, you know, to save his life, you know. And this is the part that they're trying to portray in the movie. You know, but the shooters, we're told, were members of the Nation of Islam. I think the mosque in the Bronx or something like that, if I can remember. But it turns out, you know, the two who did, you know, well, it was three of them, but two of those persons, after all these years, it turned out, you know, were innocent. They were not at that mosque. Now, another one of the brothers who was with Malcolm, you know, he had transformed his life, and you know, like a lot of other brothers did. And his name was Abdul Razak, and he had an account about being there also, okay. And he had said that when he had left, the these individual police or undercovers or whatever had stopped him or whatever, and something about getting him to come to the police station and whatnot, and some man and whatnot. Well, anyway, he was not going to this police station on his own by himself. See, and so he said when he got there, he was the rest of him, and he said when he went to the rest, he saw the same man that had the trench coat on that was at the mosque. That was at the Ottoman, bomb. Mm-hmm. And another brother who was close with Malcolm was Herman Bell. And Herman Bell reported that when he walked outside and he looked across the street, he said he had saw the police had taken another man and, you know, put him in a police car, and they drove off. You see, they had used, you know, two of the brothers in the Nation of Islam as you know, as patsies. Whereas the other brother who admitted to, you know, being there and taking part in the assassination of Malcolm X, you know, and you know, some there's some elders now who, you know, who were young at the, you know, and their close family members, you know, had explained to them, and to this day, years ago, that the killer was still, you know, walking around free in New York, you know, and people in the know, everybody knew it. See, and recently, over maybe the last month, this dying pig on the police force on his deathbed, which is a usual pattern, decided to come clean. And so he had got his nephew, and his nephew sat down and transcribed his whole account, and which has been being or has been turned into a book as we speak. But this was a police officer who admitted and taken part in his the setup of the assassination of Malcolm X, you know, and he had, you know, stayed where he was on that day and his role and what he had to do. So, you know, Malcolm was right on point about knowing that it was bigger than the Nation of Islam, so to speak, in you know, in plotting the, you know, to, you know, to murder him. In the meantime, Louis Farrakhan, who had come up on the heels of Malcolm, Malcolm had taught him. See, and he had been in the mosque, had gained you know, position to speak, and you know, Farrakhan, Louis Walcott had, you know, formerly known as Louis Walcott, who was a violinist, performing in front of orchestra. And so he had been making these speeches about, you know, having Malcolm head served upon the platter, or, you know, he had his tongue cut out or whatever, something to that nature. And so he had set the atmosphere within the nation. And so the FBI, you know, exploited that. You know, they exploited that. And so, you know, that's brought about the assassination of Malcolm X. And it changed the landscape of the Black Power movement, the Black liberation struggle, you know. It's been said that when Malcolm, you know, was murdered and that his body had lain in the morgue for X amount of days because nobody wanted to touch it, you know, for burial. You know, this comes out of, I think, Ozzie Davis, who did the, I believe, the eulogy. And when the movie Malcolm X is going off, when you hear the voice that's speaking about who is Malcolm, you know, he was one of us. That's Ozzie Davis who is speaking. That's the voice of Ozzie Davis, you know. But and also, if you look at the photos, pictures that was taken of Malcolm, you know, likely body laying there, and you see the guy is leaning over him or whatever, you know. That same guy was also undercover. And years later, had the nerve to be interviewed and spoke out and spoke about, you know, about the murder and assassination of Malcolm X. It's incredible. And just like William O'Neill years later had the nerve enough to be interviewed and talk about, you know, his part and how he, you know, didn't realize that it would get that deep and all, you know, this sort of madness. Well, first of all, you shouldn't have been there in the first place. But we understand, you know, that we had these Judas factors among us. You had them back then, you know, up on the balcony with Martin Luther King. You know, the same thing. You know, these persons who infiltrated. But the Nation of Islam was heavily infiltrated. It was heavily infiltrated. Black Panther Party was infiltrated. But these are the lessons that we learned. And he's gone physically, but he's still with us in spirit. I myself declared myself to be a student of Malcolm X. Yeah. And I make no apologies for that. He has been a very instrumental part in my growth, my learning, my understanding, and my political development, politicization, and even developing, you know, some type of ability to speak, you know, to the youth or the times or the moments when it arises. You know, he was the greatest thinker this country ever produced. You know, hands down. And there are those who have tried to shove W.E.B. Du Bois down our throat. You know, but Malcolm had a living legacy that still lives on, and we have to keep it going and have to keep it moving. And so, you know, I hope, you know, was able to, you know, do a good tribute to our elder, my hero, and I'm quite sure others' hero too. You know, I'm just speaking personally, you know, forgive me for that. But, you know, man, the struggle continues. And when that reporter asked Malcolm about freedom, and he asked Malcolm what was the price of that freedom. Malcolm said the price of freedom is death. You know, so you know, we wanna end on that note. If we can get a little music, a little something. we got a couple of minutes. Something to take us out, you know, with Brother Malcolm.
You're one against the other. In the past, the greatest weapon the white man has had has been his ability to divide and conquer. As Jackie Robinson pointed out beautifully on the television last night, 4/5 of the world isn't white. Isn't that what Jackie said? And if 4/5 of the world is dark, how is it possible for 1/5 to rule, oppress, exploit, dominate, and brutalize the 4/5 who are in the majority?
How do they do it?
Divide and conquer. If I take my hand and slap you, you don't even feel it. It might sting you because these digits are separated. But all I have to do to put you back in your place is bring those digits together. This is what the white man has done to you and me. He has divided us and used us one against the other. But today, thanks to Allah, you can say thanks to God or thanks to Jesus or thanks to Jehovah, whatever you want. But as a follower of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, we have been taught to say thanks to Allah. And that's what Jesus said. Jesus called on Allah. He said, Allah, Allah, lama asabatani. I believe what's good for Jesus is good for you. If Allah was good enough for Jesus to call upon, I think he should be good enough for you to call upon. Since the so-called Negro community has shot the white man by resisting all efforts to divide us, I think that you and I should continue to shock him by staying and working together in unity. Despite religious, political, economic, or educational, or social differences, let us remember that we're not brutalized because we're Baptist. We're not brutalized because we're Methodist. We're not brutalized because we're Muslims. We're not brutalized because we're Catholic. We're brutalized because we are black people in America. Here, your mother is being raped and you're not supposed to be emotional. Your women, please, your women can't walk the street without some cracker putting his hands on her, and you're not supposed to be emotional. If you say that you're fed up, if you teach the Negro, people don't even know their own name. Why? Because he took it away from them. Please, please. 20 million black people don't even know their own language. Why? Because he took it away from them. 20 million black people who don't even know the history of their ancestors. Why? Because he took it away from them. And if you try and tell them how thoroughly and completely they've been robbed, he says you're teaching hate. That's something to think about. Today you are coming out of college. You're coming out of the leading universities. You're trying to go in a good direction, but you don't know which direction to go in. And if somebody tries to take you right to the root of your problem, they say that that man's a hate teacher. If I ask why should the senators in Washington, and then again if we tell you that Negroes are being hung on the tree or being shot down illegally, unjustly, and those Negroes should do something to protect themselves, you say you're advocating violence. The white man is tricking you. He's trapping you. He doesn't call it violence when he lands troops in South Vietnam. Come, please, please, please. He doesn't call it violence when he lands troops in Berlin. When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, he didn't say get nonviolent. He said, praise the Lord, but pass the ammunition. But when someone attacks you, when someone comes at you with a club, when someone comes at you with a rope, when someone comes at you with a gun, despite the fact that you've done nothing, he tells you, suffer peacefully. Pray for those who use you despitefully. Be long-suffering. And how long can you suffer after suffering for 400 years? So I just want to clear up that little point right there, because he says that we play on your emotions. And when you turn on your television tonight, or your radio, or read the newspaper, they're going to tell you in that paper that I was playing on your emotions. Imagine you, a second-class citizen. That's not getting emotional, it's getting intelligent. And as far as your mayor is concerned, I see you should say their mayor, a man named Yorty, who has been slandering the Muslims, a professional liar. Who has mastered the art of using half-truths. Put it in the paper that they broke into our religious place of worship and got records that they can use to prove that most of us have criminal records. You can't be a Negro in America and not have a criminal record. Martin Luther King has been to jail. Please. James Farmer has been to jail. Why, you can't name a black man in this country who is sick and tired of the hell that he's catching who hasn't been to jail. Charged him with being seditious. They put Moses in jail. They put Daniel in jail. Why, you haven't got a man of God in the Bible that wasn't put to jail when they started speaking out against exploitation and oppression. They charged Jesus with sedition. Didn't they do that? They said he was against Caesar. They said he was discriminating because he told his disciples, go not the way of the Gentiles, but rather go to the lost sheep. He discriminated. Don't go near the Gentiles. Go to the lost sheep. Go to the oppressed. Go to the downtrodden. Go to the exploited. Go to the people who don't know who they are, who are lost from the knowledge of themselves, and who are strangers in a land that is not theirs. Go to those people. Go to the slaves. Go to the second-class citizens. Go to the ones who are suffering the brunt of Caesar's brutality. And if Jesus were here in America today, he wouldn't be going to the white man. The white man is the oppressor. He would be going to the oppressed. He would be going to the humble. He would be going to the lowly. He would be going to the rejected and the despised. He would be going to the so-called American Negro. To have once been a criminal is no disgrace. To remain a criminal is the disgrace. I formerly was a criminal. I formerly was in prison. I'm not ashamed of that. You never can use that over my head. And that he's using the wrong stick. I don't feel that stick. I went to prison because I believed in men like Sam Yorty. I went to prison because I trusted men like Sam Yorty. I went to prison following the philosophy of men like Sam Yorty. But since I've been following the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, I have been reformed, and that's more, please. That's more than Sam Yorty and Chief Parker and all these other white politicians have been able to do with the inmates in the prisons of this state. They should give Mr. Muhammad credit. They should give Mr. Muhammad credit for reforming and rehabilitating men whom they have failed to reform and rehabilitate. Mayor Yorty referred to some press report that Mr. Muhammad had once been found guilty of contributing to the delinquency of a minor. He failed to explain purposely that in 1934,